Very good. So we will start this with a good question, but what is actually the NMR is or the nuclear magnetic resonance, which we have the acronym NMR, what is it all about? This is the photo of our 18.8 Tesla magnet in the downstairs of Nanoscience Center here on the campus. So it's the one of our NMR machines in a way that are available for biomolecular NMR studies. It happens to be the second strongest one in terms of magnetic field in Finland. There's one 850 megahertz system. This is 800 megahertz system, and that is located in University of Helsinki in Viikin campus. But let's talk about this magnetic field and their effect on the data quality a bit later. So what is NMR? Actually, the acronym in the Finnish version is says that NMR or no more research or whatever, in a way, because the techniques it's quite unique among the any spectroscopy techniques, because the parameters or observables that you can see in NMR is quite say overwhelming sometimes. So anyway, it's a spectroscopic technique based on the nuclear magnetic resonance, so that we have certain atoms or nuclei, isotopes, that absorb electromagnetic radiation at the high magnetic field strength. So the practical outcome is shown here on the bottom right-hand corner, which is the proton or the hydrogen spectrum of urine. So we can see number of lines there stemming from the different hydrogens in the sample. And of course, urine has a lot of small molecular metabolites in there, and we can basically see all of them if the concentration of that compound is high enough for the detection with the current experimental setting. Basically, we are talking about the interaction of the matter with the electromagnetic waves at the radio frequencies. That means starting from 60 megahertz and reaching nowadays maybe to 1.5 gigahertz, basically. There are now installed 1.2 gigahertz systems where the magnetic field is 1.2 gigahertz in terms of proton frequency, which are way beyond 20 teslas in magnetic field strength units. But what you can see here, that compared to gamma rays or X-rays, you can see that the frequencies are quite much lower, but also the energy is way much lower. So that's why this NMR is non-invasive technique. So it can be used for imaging as well without any harm or damage caused to the object we are actually investigating. It also means that the energy difference between the energy states are extremely small. And from that, it follows also that the line width is relatively small. We will get a very high resolution. And then the spectral data, it contains information on different interactions between the atoms. So What are the applications of NMR? So one could say that it's one of the most versatile analytical tools available. It was already invented in 1946 by Edward Purcell and Bloch, and they got the Nobel Prize a big couple of years later from this. And so the NMR enables the studies of the composition, the structure, also the dynamics and the function of wide range of different kind of chemical molecules. It's widely applied to structural elucidation of synthetic products, study of kinetics or dynamic processes, study of biomolecular structure, drug discovery, metabolics, and also the magnetic resonance imaging. So we can divide the NMR in two different parts. It's the NMR, the high resolution part that we are using here as a structural elucidation tool. But there's also this MRI, which is the magnetic resonance imaging, the low resolution part. Why they are called differently, why it's nuclear magnetic resonance and magnetic resonance imaging, stems from the medical kind of reasons, because the patients, if they are exposed to something which is nuclear magnetic, it doesn't bring up any good vibrations in them. So that's why they remove this nuclear magnetic there. So it's like only the magnetic resonance imaging, although the physics is exactly the same behind the phenomenon. Nevertheless, it's the low resolution technique where we are basically measuring how much there is water in our tissues, and it has a very nice applications therein, but we are not going into details about them. Instead, we are focusing on this high resolution part, the nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. It can be divided to solid state NMR, which is a kind of an emerging technique because it allows the single crystal studies and even the, something that it's not soluble like membrane proteins in the high magnetic field. It gives you the unique information, but that is also beyond the focus of this course. Instead, we are focusing on the solution state NMR, which is used also in structural biology and also in other domains of say biomedicine or so, in metabolomics and also, of course, in the chemistry and chemical analysis. So there are some important years in history of NMR, but I'm not going into details. You can look at the literature yourself about this, but you can see anyway that there are a number of Nobel Prizes given in the NMR spectroscopy technique itself. The most recent related to structural biology was the Nobel Prize given to Kurt Wüthrich from EDH Zurich in chemistry, where he got the Nobel Prize for developing of NMR methodology for the protein or biomolecular structure determination. So to what we can employ the NMR then? It, as I mentioned, it's a very versatile technique, so it allows the structural elucidation of different molecules, like a verification of chemical synthesis, which is very much implied in organic chemistry. We can identify the unknown substances also, and we can look at the molecular mobility or the translational diffusion. We can follow up the chemical reactions, enzymatic reactions in real time. We can carry out inside the living cell. We can see the metabolic concentrations, and we can determine the intracellular pH inside the living cells. We can identify different physiological states through the metabolic studies. And also, like in this course, we can apply it in structural biology and biophysics to study the biomolecular structure and dynamics and function. So here is just one example of kind of a small molecule structure determination, which was solely done with NMR autoproton and carbon NMR spectrum, which is from one, the molecule Hasaladin D, which is a glycopeptide from cyanobacterium. But this is more like a classical de novo structure determination by NMR spectroscopy, which is kind of a different way of doing the structure determination that nowadays we are doing for proteins as such. Then another example is the identification of metabolites in the blood serum that we take sera sample or something, some other body fluids like urine or so, and we put it inside the magnet and we measure the proton or the hydrogen spectrum, and then we can compare between the different patients, for instance, or the samples that what are the metabolites that we are seeing, what are their actual concentration in the bloodstream or so. So like here is the difference between the lactate level and the glucose level for one patient with the tick-borne disease and sort of a positive control of healthy person. So then it's kind of a quantitative way of comparing the disease states reported by the metabolites. But our focus anyway, although NMR is a very versatile in these studies as well, but our focus is of course now in this course in structural biology and the biophysics. So that is mostly to determine the biomolecular structure and studying their interaction with their ligands. So this is the slide that I like to show very often in these NMR courses are like a proton spectrum or the hydrogen spectrum of 20 kilodalton calcium binding protein calreuterine from insignificant bacterium, if you like, the Cyclosporospora erythrea. So here is the structure and here is the proton or the hydrogen spectrum of this molecule. So what it actually, there is a workflow in a way that what took place when we carried out these studies to determine the structure of this protein. So it included 97, the cloning and expression, labeling and purification of the protein, then screening of the NMR conditions, data collections, assignment or the analysis of the spectra, collecting the distance restraints through NOE spectra and other structural restraints, finally the structure calculation and refinement and validation and the publication of results in 2003. So you could say that it took 5 to 6 years to determine the structure of this protein. If I would argue that NMR is a high-throughput method, you would certainly say that I'm lying or I'm insane. So certainly NMR is not a high-throughput method in a way for the protein structure determination, although we have been doing quite a bit of roughly about 30 structures past 15 years or so because of the streamlining of methodology and approaches that we are currently using. Anyway, if the NMR is not a high throughput method for studying the protein structure or the biological macromolecules, why should you bother using it? First of all, you don't need the crystals. You were learning to do, of course, the X-ray crystallography in the previous lectures. And the requirement for the crystal or doing the crystal structure is that you need the crystals. So in NMR, we are studying the things in the solution state. One could argue that the conditions are a bit more like native compared to crystal lattice. But more importantly, we can study, as I mentioned in my previous lecture, of this intrinsically disordered or the unstructured states, which are impossible, or at least next to impossible, to study with the crystallography or so, because of the elevated dynamics involved. Those things can be studied in NMR. And this is a big chunk of the domain of structural biology, the dark proteome part that we are starting to learn their significance in our biology. We can do the molecular interactions in solution, so we can do the binding epitope mapping at the residue level. We do not only see that where that our ligand is binding to the protein or so, we can see where it binds and how strong is the binding, and we can also detect the very low affinity interaction, millimolar interactions in terms of dissociation constant or KD. We can characterize the dynamics and mobility in various timescales, from picoseconds to days, which involves the folding, kinetics, enzymatic reactions, domain movements, and so on. Nevertheless, here are some statistics related to soul structure determination by NMR compared to X-ray crystallography, and we can see that certainly X-ray crystallography dominates in the soul structure determination of, for instance, protein structures. But nevertheless, NMR and the crystallography are complementary techniques to each other. So it's clearly that there is no kind of a be-all, end-all methodology to the structural biology, but we do should learn in a way to select the most appropriate technique for your protein or for your biological question at hand. So as I mentioned already, these are the things that the structure determination of different biological compounds, the dynamics from picoseconds to seconds or minutes or days, molecular interactions from picomolar to tens of millimolar binding affinities, hydrogen deuterium exchange rate. But in addition to those, like more general parameters, you can see that the residue specific pKa values for the glutamate or lysine and or the histidine, and you can determine that what is this pKa value of the certain side chain of the lysine, for instance, and in what condition in your mutant or in different protein, different but similar protein or so. You can also look at the histidine tautomery, in which, because we can see the protons, you can determine that at which nitrogen that proton is attached in the histidine. Or you can do the translational diffusion studies, you can see the enzymatic activity and so on. And that's why, because of these things, NMR is also used for drug molecule screening or the ligand optimization. So because we can see also the ligand side quite nicely, even if you would not be seeing the protein side. And we can do the NMR inside the living cells nowadays, although it's a not everyday technique in a way, but it's expensive, but certainly it's possible. And here are some examples of protein or protein structures or in the, some carbohydrates and small molecular structures that have been determined by NMR throughout the years. So to what kind of system NMR is then good for? One could say that the targets for the NMR, although which might be challenging, but they are certainly possible, are the modular proteins. And then also nowadays, even the integral membrane proteins, especially if we are talking about the solid state NMR. I'm not going into details regarding that because of the limit in our time, but nevertheless, you should be aware that for instance, with the solution, but also with the solid state NMR studies, you can even study the integral membrane proteins these days. But it's especially good for this partially unfolded or intrinsically disordered proteins, which have this flexible part, like also the modular proteins can have the flexible disorder part between the ordered or structured domains. So I have here a quite nice example from our collaborator or studies with Mart Saarma's group, which is the long-term collaboration that we have been doing with him. He's studying these so-called neurotropic factors, which are able to protect and rescue neurons in the Parkinson's disease. So as an alternative treatment for the Parkinson's disease. And actually, we started the collaboration with doing the protein structure determination of one of the protein or the neurotrophic factor, which is called MANF. And the MANF, they initially carried out the structure determination with X-ray crystallography. And then it turned out to be that the structure revealed that there are probably two domains in the protein. The N-terminal domain, which is very well structured, and then less structured or more fuzzy one is the C-terminal part, which is kind of contains this polyalanine helices, helix 6 and 7 shown here in the red color. And the conclusion was that because the electron densities were so poor that they need to replace the sequence of the polyalanine to model it, the C-terminal part. So they came into a conclusion that the C-terminal part of MANF is intrinsically disordered. So we have been seeing, and as I mentioned in my previous lecture, that how does the proton NMR spectrum of the disordered protein looks like. We will look that into a later phase. We will start suspecting that this is not the case. Instead, we determined the structure of this MANF with NMR, and it revealed two structural domains which show quite a bit of flexibility in the linker between them, which then hampers the crystallization or the structure determination by crystallography for this protein. Whereas in the NMR spectrum, we could easily see the N-terminal domain nicely, the ensemble are nicely superimposable, and the same holds true also for the C-terminal part. But as you can see in this image at the bottom right corner, that we cannot really superimpose the C-terminal and the N-terminal part at the same time because of the flexibility in the linker. So we were able to determine the structure of the C-terminal domain as well, and it shows this, the homology for the BAX inhibitor of QE7, the subdomain, and we are still continuing the studies with Mart Sarma's group regarding this topic. But this kind of highlights the thing that although you can crystallize the protein, it doesn't give you the full picture of the things necessarily. As the same holds true also for the NMR, that you cannot study everything with the NMR. You should try to do the crystallography or cryo-EM or so. So after this example, I will next use some time for explaining the NMR theory on a very, let's say, basic level. I'm not going into very much into details because it would require the lecture series of its own. So this is always quite a bit of challenge to the explaining the things in an understandable way in a relatively short time scale. But let's try this, and you can always come up with the questions or send me email or visit me if we can arrange an additional session if you want to learn things more about this. So what is it the NMR is all about? So certain atoms, as I mentioned, they have the property which is called the magnetic dipole moment, which is stemming from the spinning charge of a spin, which has a spin angular momentum I. And this is scaled with the gyromagnetic ratio, which is the property of the spin, which we are calling gamma. So depending if the atom has the in its core, if it's because you know that it's composed of protons and neutrons with spin. So if there is a even number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus, then it doesn't have this magnetic dipole moment. It's non-magnetic, and if it's non-magnetic, it's not magnetically active in the NMR. So if there is an even or odd number of protons and neutrons or vice versa, then we will have, or the spin will have, the magnetic dipole moment, which gives the NMR signal. And biologically, let's say so that almost every element has at least one isotope which is NMR active. But of course, in biology, we are interested in hydrogens, carbons, nitrogens, phosphorus. Also, the oxygens would be of our interest, but its NMR properties are, let's say, less than ideal at the moment. So that's why we are not really focusing on that spin. Nevertheless, as you can see, that the proton or the hydrogen has the natural abundance almost 100%. And then carbon has the, or the carbon 13 has the natural abundance of 1.11%, whereas the carbon 12 is its natural abundance is very high, but unfortunately it's not active magnetically. So it's to have the magnetic dipole moment of zero. And then the nitrogen 15 happens to be having the very low natural abundance as well, but its so-called spin half, its spin angular momentum is half or 0.5, if you will. So it has the properties which are very suitable for the NMR. The nitrogen 14 here, which has a natural abundance very high, you can see that its spin angular momentum I is 1, which makes the quadrupolar spin. So the line width and the other properties of that spin are less than ideal for the NMR. So that's why we are specifically interested in those isotopes. And I should mention that when we are talking about the proton, we are talking about the protium isotope. So it's the one isotope of hydrogen. There are two additional isotopes, which are deuterium and tritium, which are also magnetically active, but their natural abundance is much lower, and that's why we are sticking on this proton or protium. Anyway, so we can find these carbons and protons and nitrogen and phosphorus in different biological or the biomolecules, and then we can study these quite nicely and their interaction all together. So like in the amino acid residues, as you know, they are composed of these elements, and they build up proteins and nucleotides. The same thing, they have the phosphorus in the backbone as well, and they compose the nucleic acids, and then the sugars are forming the carbohydrates. And all these domains we can do the NMR, and same holds true also for the lipids to some degree. So what is then the origin of the NMR signals? So we need to have the NMR active spin, and if we happen to have this NMR active spin, it gives the NMR signal. So if you think of a familiar molecule of ethanol shown here, if we put the ethanol inside the magnetic field, we can, or let's say that if it's in the room or the Earth magnetic field, like a very bottom part of this figure here, I can try to activate my pointer. So in this part, we can see that if there is no external magnetic field or it's very low, these pins stemming from the sample, they are oriented in disordered way. There is no orientation. But when we put them in the large magnetic field, like 18 Teslas or so, we can see that some of the spins are aligning parallel, and some of them are aligning anti-parallel towards the field. These spins, which are in the parallel oriented, are called so-called alpha state, the higher energy state. And then this beta state here, which is the anti-parallel, it's the defined by this m minus half or so. So every atom with the spin number half is divided to two different energy states. And it happens to be so that in the magnetic field, the number of these energy states or spins in this alpha state, there's a small excess of spins in this alpha state, which is higher than the spins in the beta state. And the difference, I mean, the cancel, these states, energy states are canceling each other out, and the excess of spins in alpha states gives this so-called net magnetization, which is then aligned along the polarization magnetic field. And the distribution or the population of these energy states is based on the Boltzmann distribution, which depends on the in the energy and the temperature. And how the magnetic field then comes into play for the whole equation is that this energy difference between the alpha and beta state is can be seen through the magnetic field strength. So the frequency here is depending on the angular frequency of the precession where the spins are making around the magnetic field depends on the magnetic field strength. So the higher the magnetic field strength, the higher the frequency. But also you can see that the higher the magnetic field, the higher the population are in this, let's say, this alpha state. So the population difference increases along with the strength of the polarizing magnetic field. So it gives us more observable net magnetization, that is higher sensitivity. So then how the NMR, how we will get eventually the signal that we are detecting. Now, if we think about still the ethanol molecule in the magnetic field, the excess of these alpha spins in the alpha state gives the net magnetization, which is now oriented along the magnetic field, along the z-axis, if you like. So the spin transition can be then induced by external magnetic field, the radio frequency field B1, which is perpendicular to this polarizing magnetic field, the strong magnetic field, and the B0. So when this B1 field is oscillating at the precession frequency of the spins we are interested in, for example, if we have the 800 megahertz system at the proton frequency, if this field is at the 800 megahertz field, it can excite the protons, which are then precessing at that frequency. So then the B1 field creates the coherence among the spins, and it turns the magnetization from the z-axis to xy plane. And so we are now the magnetization is not anymore in the z-axis, but it's along the xy plane or so. And then it starts, these spins start to precess around the z-axis on this xy plane. And finally, they will relax back to equilibrium, back to the z-axis, to this initial state. But our detector lies on this x and y axis, and we can see the speed where these spins are rotating around the z-axis. So how does the NMR signal then looks like? If we have a single frequency, let's say the Greek frequency of let's say the ethane or so, or methane, which is there is four protons which are degenerated magnetically. They mean that they have the single frequency, the more molecule is highly symmetric. So if we are talking about these four protons, we could see the single frequency, which is slowly decaying, as you can see. Nothing in life lasts forever. The same thing is also for the NMR signal. It doesn't last forever. And if we make a Fourier transform of this time domain oscillating signal here, we get to the frequency domain through the Fourier transform here. And we will see that these four protons would be resonating at exactly the same frequency. And the line width of this signal is defined how fast this signal is decaying. So the faster the decay, the broader the signal. As it's shown here, that the T2, which is a so-called transversal relaxation time. So if this number is long, then the signal will be decaying longer. Okay? And if this T2 value is short, then we have a very rapid relaxation and the signal will be broad. So what about then the multiple frequencies? So if we have a, let's say so that we have the molecule like ethanol, it contains three different kind of protons. It contains the methyl group, it contains the methylene group and the hydroxyl group, right? So we can make the Fourier transform of this time domain spectrum or the signal, and we would find out that there are three different frequencies because there are three different chemical environments in the ethanol molecule. There is the methyl chemistry, and then there's a ethylene group, and then there's a hydroxyl group. And these three protons are all in different chemical environment, and that's why they give a different kind of, or the NMR frequency at a different position on the frequency axis. Here in the upper part, you can see that the NM proton spectrum of this ethanol molecule with the low resolution, we can still separate these three different chemical groups, if you will. And then in the lower part, you can see from the modern high resolution NMR spectrometer, the spectrum of ethanol, which shows also this fine structure in the groups, which are stemming from the couplings between these chemical groups. But I'm not going into details in this lecture, how they are coming from or stemming from. So how does the actual spectrometer then look like? We have the, well, you saw the image already, but we have, of course, we have the polarizing magnetic field itself. Then we have inside the magnet so-called probe head, which contains this external magnetic field, the oscillating field at the radio frequency. And then we have the detector coils as well inside this probe head. And our sample goes inside the magnet, and then it goes inside the probe head to these saddle coils inside the probe head. And this probe head is then connected to the console, which contains the amplifiers and frequency generators and waveform generators and so on. And this is connected to our host computer. But the magnet itself, it's the solenoid, superconductive state niobium titanium wire, and it's in the low temperature of Kelvin, 2 to 4 kelvins or so. So there is negligible resistance and minimal current loss. So it can sustain the field for years without external power source, but we have to put liquid helium inside the system which is like an external power source. So the evolution of this magnet technology started already in the 50s, where there were this 14 and even the 60 megahertz systems. And then it has been steadily increasing the way that 2006, we reached the 950 megahertz field. And that sort of seemed to be like an upper limit with the current technology. And then with the current or the previous technology, they built the magnet of 1 gigahertz, 1,000 megahertz, which was a price tag of 10 million euros. So it's a pretty expensive toy to play with. Of course, nothing compared to the price of a synchrotron or so, but for the single device, it is quite expensive. Then, during the worst corona time in the spring, they were able to install the first 1.2 gigahertz NMR spectrum meter in Germany, and it was a price tag about the same price as this old technology 1 gigahertz system. So it's quite a achievement. Our 800 is price tag is around 1.5 million. So it's like a quite expensive, but it's peanuts compared to these systems. So what can we do with why we want to use the higher magnetic field? I already explained that we will get the higher signal to noise because there is more net magnetization to detect with NMR. And the sensitivity has always been an issue with an NMR. So that helps in that well, but then there's also the resolution part. So you can understand that the resolution scales with the strength of this magnetic field. When the hertz numbers increasing here, then the resolution is always better. So here is the proton-nitrogen correlation, two-dimensional correlation spectrum. I will explain this more detail later, of a construct of a filamine containing the domains 16 to 21, 557 residues measured at the 600 megahertz frequency, and then at the 800 megahertz frequency. So you can now think about that how would the spectrum look like at the frequency of 1.2 gigahertz. So the resolution and the sensitivity, they come with money, unfortunately. So what are the NMR observables then? What we are talking about, what we are actually measuring in the signal. First, I would like to emphasize the difference between the crystallography and the NMR. In the crystal structure determination, we are building first the crystals, you need the crystals, and then you are having the electron density map. And if the electron density map is excellent and there's no phase problem, you can determine the structure of your protein or small molecule, whatever. But in NMR, this is done in quite, let's say, a bit different way because it's not a form of direct spectroscopy. We are not, even we are talking about the spectroscopy, which is scoping, seeing something. We are not directly seeing anything. We are just indirectly seeing things. So it's not a microscope, although it's called NMR spectroscopy. So if you think that the proteins are built from amino acids, which are then linked together somehow, and we are building a puzzle, well, this is not, this is the Capitol Hill, as you can see. But nevertheless, it's like a building a puzzle here, and it's based on these NMR observables, the chemicals surrounding the chemical shift, the frequency that we are seeing, and the interactions between the frequencies that are used as restraints that we are then building our protein model. And it works. It gives you the more or less the same outcome as the crystallography, but in a different way. So what we can see in the NMR spectrum, there was this, again, that this ethanol spectrum from 1951, and here you can see all the relevant things, and then also the with the high resolution version of this more relevant things. So these NMR observables are found in the Hamiltonian that is describing the method. There is the chemical shift of spin, for example, the spin I, which could be the proton, and the spin S, which could be another proton or some carbon or nitrogen in the system. Their chemical shift can be seen like here, different frequencies. Then, if we have the high resolution version, we start seeing also the peak splittings, which are due to spin couplings, the smaller energy differences, which allows us to link these spins together. And then there are also, I should mention that NMR is a quantitative method, so that we the higher the peak, the integral of the peak or the volume of the peak, more protons or the nuclei it has. And then also we can see that the different line widths, like this line is broader here because of the dynamics, because it's coming from the hydroxyl group. And the hydroxyl is exchanging proton with let's say, the bulk water. And this hydrogen is not, it's a labeled proton, so we can see the dynamics that there's some kind of exchange going on. So the NMR observables can be divided to this chemical shift, scalar coupling, relaxation, and dipolar coupling. So the chemical shift is clearly the most important, and it's the precession frequency around the static magnetic field, or the angular velocity, if you will. And it's sensitive to the chemical environment, so you can use it for the structural characterization. So here is an example of a small protein, ubiquitin 76 residues. And for example, it contains the 76 amino acid residues. And if we think about the valine residue here, for instance, we can see that the valine amide protein is resonating in from 6 to 9 or 10 ppm. This is a ppm scale, parts per million scale. It's the dimensionless scale. It's actually the frequency scale, but we are using this ppm scale that we can compare the frequencies between the different spectrometers, like the 500 megahertz to 950. They always, the ppm scale is always the same. Then the alpha proton, what we are seeing here, which is attached to alpha carbon, it's the backbone alpha proton, and it's resonating close to this residual water signal here. So something like 3 to 5.5 ppm. Then we have the sidechain signals. Those can be from 4 ppm to 1 ppm or so. And then the methyl groups here, which are typically less than 1 ppm. They can be even on the negative side of the ppm scale. So that's roughly what we are seeing from the for the proton chemical shifts. The carbon chemical shifts can be used in a similar fashion. We can see that the carbonyl carbon, which doesn't contain a proton attached to it, it's resonating there in 170 to 180 ppm. Aromatic parts from phenyl anhydrides or tryptophanes, or so they are resonating from 110 to 140 ppm or so. And the methyls, again, in the lower parts of the frequency scale or the ppm scale. So these residues now, which our probing is composed of residues, the structure of the residues is known, as you know. So we can identify these residues based on their characteristic proton and carbon chemical shifts. If you think about the alanine, which contains one proton, the alpha proton, and then, I mean, in the side chain kind of, and then the methyl proteins. We can see two different groups at the certain chemical shifts. So alanine is quite easy to identify. It same holds true also for the carbon frequencies, alpha carbon and the beta carbon. So all these residues can be identified, but of course you can see that there's quite a bit of overlap for some residues, and we cannot then completely identify them from this kind of spectrum that which belongs to each residue, and especially if there is a multiple number of same residues, like 10 valines, how we can make a difference between them. We are talking about that tomorrow, how it is accomplished. Nevertheless, then we have the scalar coupling interaction in addition to chemical shift. And the scalar coupling interaction in the structural analysis can be used for restraining the backbone or side chain conformation, the angles between the atoms in the polypeptide. So for instance, if we have the coupling between the amide proton and the alpha proton larger than 8 hertz, it tells that the phi angle is having the certain angles, which is like an extended structure, like in the beta sheet. Or if it's the less than 4.5 hertz, it's just then implying that it's in the helical conformation compared to. So it can be used as a structural restraint. But also it is, which is not kind of covered here in detail, but it's used for the magnetization transfer between the space. Then there's a relaxation, which is linked to the dynamics. And it's a T2, there are two relaxation mechanisms actually. The T2 relaxation, which defines the line width, how fast the signal is decaying, as I already mentioned. And then there's a T1, which is how fast the signal is back to equilibrium state after the pulse or so. It's just defining the scanning rate. So we can see from these graphs that because the T2 depends almost linearly the rotational correlation time, tau C, of the molecule, that is the molecular weight, we see that the higher the molecular weight becomes, the shorter this T2 time comes and the faster the decay of the signal. So if we have a large protein or high molecular weight system, the line width happens to be very large. Whereas if we have the slow relaxation, we will have a narrow lines with the small molecule. If you take some small inhibitor molecule, measure the NMR spectrum, you will see very sharp lines. And then if you take the 50 kilo Dalton probe and you will see very broad lines. And that sets the upper limit for the protein size or the molecule size that you can really determine the structure or study in detail because of the line width will get too broad at some point and we lose the signal. Well, that's why the NMR is not suitable for very large systems, because the lines are getting very broad. There is a special case of this relaxation in addition to this T2 and T1, which is called dipolar cross relaxation. And this is a very important thing, that if we have two spins, let's say two protons, I and S, if we saturate one of them with the low frequency, radio frequency, we can see either the enhancement of the signal or the sign change of the signal of the spin, which is close in proximity of the spin S that we are saturating. And that sign chain depends on the rotational correlation time. So for the small molecules, this cross-relaxation rate is positive, whereas for the slow tumbling system, it's negative. So what is important to take a home message here is that this nuclear Overhauser effect, this dipolar cross-relaxation, is proportional to the inverse of sixth power of the interatomic distance of two nuclei. So because of this inverse sixth power dependence, we can see that we can only measure the NOEs, the magnetization transfer through this mechanism, for the distances for 5 to 6 angstroms. Because already at the 5 to 6 angstroms, if you start something like 2 angstroms distance, we can are pretty close to zero already at the 6 angstroms. But that's sort of the upper limit that we can really see. We will talk about that also in detail, more detail later. Then there is another special case that we can see in terms of dynamics, which is a chemical exchange. So if you think about the dynamic equilibrium in molecules, that there are two conformations, A and B, like in this molecule. Here, there is a rate constant that the conversion from A to B and back. So for example, this molecule has this oxygens double bonded to nitrogens, and this bond between two nitrogens is rotating slowly. So because there is a partial double bond character in this molecule, this is the molecule is more or less like a planar. But there is a certain energy that will bring this from state A to conformation B. So in NMR, we can see that if this exchange, the rate of exchange is slow compared to NMR's time scale, we can see the conformation A and the conformation B in the spectrum and the different frequency. When this exchange or the rate of exchange is increasing, we can see that at some point we almost lose the signal. It becomes very broad. And that is called coalescence point, when this rate of exchange is approaching or is roughly around the chemical or the frequency difference between the two states. Then if this rotation, because of, for example, heating is increasing, then we will see the average of these populations or the two states in the mid part, if they are 50-50 population, we can see that this sharp peak exactly between the at the midpoint of two frequencies. So this is very important phenomenon in protein ligand interaction studies that you're actually then doing on Friday, that you have to kind of keep this in mind, because this is related to dissociation, like how fast the ligand is dissociating from the complex. And that can be seen, this phenomenon, also in the NMR spectrum, and allows you to determine the dissociation constant at the residue level. Finally, there's, I wanted to mention shortly, the dipolar coupling, which is a true space coupling between the spins, and it's modulated by the molecular tumbling, and it has a dependence on the internuclear orientation and distance between two spins. So the practical outcome for this is that we can carry out, as I mentioned, the NOEs are only the short distance information, 5 to 6 horns. So this goes much beyond that, because it's the long range structural information. It allows to orient the two domains, for instance, which are not closed in space, by measuring the dipolar couplings between them. It also allows the structural validation, like here, comparison of the crystal structure and actually the residual dipolar couplings that we are measuring in the solution state, and they give a very high correlation between the amide nitrogen and amide proton and alpha proton and alpha carbon dipolar couplings. So it tells that the crystal structure and the NMR structures are highly similar, irrespective that they are in the structure are determined in the different lattice. They also gives information about the dynamics or the domain movements, like shown here for this filamine 16 to 21 construct. It shows significant interdomain motions that we cannot fit these residual dipolar couplings for the model that we have in the proteins or kind of an intact model. So there must be some inter-domain movement going on. And actually, there is quite a bit of movement between the domains 16 to 19 with respect to 20 to 21. And if we take that into account in the rigid body modeling, we can get a much nicer fit. So then I will use rest of the time of the day describing this multi-dimensional NMR that we are then talking about and tomorrow, and then also a bit how we start the NMR studies. So this is the general scheme for two-dimensional NMR. So this far I've been mostly showing you the proton spectrum, the one-dimensional NMR experiment, but we can measure the two and or more dimensions in the NMR. And in two-dimensional NMR, we have a so-called preparation period, and then the mixing period, and the direct observation period. And between the preparation and the mixing period, there is this indirectly detected dimension, or the evolution period. So it's indirectly detected because we are changing the otherwise this pulse sequence shown here for the COSY experiment. It contains two radio frequency pulses, and then this observation of the actual physical detection of the signal. But the only difference between these experiments, what is the variable? It is this T1, which is increasing by each step. So we are steadily start increasing the time delay between these two pulses. And it makes the signal to modulate during the T1 period. And we can connect that with the magnetization transfer that we can use to these interactions that I was talking about, the observables, the NOE or the scalar coupling interaction, to transfer the magnetization from one place to another. So here is an example of this two-dimensional NMR in the time domain signal, that we have this direct acquisition period. It's more or less constant always, but then we start taking point by point these indirectly detected points. That is that we change the width of this T1 period either linearly or non-linearly. And if we make a Fourier transform now, not only along this directly detected dimension, but also along the T1, the indirectly detected dimension, we will get the signal which has a frequency and the line width determined by the relaxation and the resolution in each dimension. So one could argue that, well, what's the point to doing this? Well, it looks nice in a way, but what's the catch here? And the thing is that if we think about the magnetization transfer now through the scalar coupling interaction that I mentioned, the J coupling, if two protons, H, let's say A and X, are not coupled to each other, we only see so-called autocorrelation peaks, two diagonal peaks that we would be already seeing in the one-dimensional experiment. So there's no point of doing this two-dimensional thing. But if there is coupling which is larger than 0 hertz, for example, between the amide proton and alpha proton, in addition to the autocorrelation peaks, we will see the cross peaks. And that tells that these two frequencies are correlated. The same thing holds true also for this dipolar cross-relaxation interaction. So in the two-dimensional NOSI experiment, that if there is no coupling, two protons nearby are not within 5 to 6 ohms, we cannot see any cross peaks. But if they are within the 5 to 6 ohms in space, not through the chemical bonds or the bonding electron interactions, but they are physically close in space, we will see the magnetization transfer in terms of these cross peaks. And we know that these two spins must be within 5 or 6 ohms in space. So how does the actual two-dimensional NOSI spectrum of a small protein looks like? It's shown here. We have the diagonal signals here across the spectrum. And then on the red background, we will see the cross peaks, that some amide proton sees the correlations here to the side chains of aliphatic protons, for instance. And it also, we can take another residue here, it also sees correlations between the two amide protons here. There are cross peaks that we can find. But it also sees the correlation then to the aliphatic sites and so on. So in this way, it's possible to build the distance map I was talking about. We will look at that also in a bit more detail later. Then we can just multiply this dimension with it by to 3-dimensional, to 4-dimensional, even the n-dimensional NMR. So we can reduce the overlap that is taking place in one-dimensional spectrum, in two-dimensional, there is less overlap in three-dimensional spectrum, and even less in four-dimensional. But the downside is that it takes longer time and it's less sensitive. We can do this also, and nowadays are doing it beyond the protons, so that we take into account the nitrogen 15 and the carbon 13 spins, that we can transfer the magnetization in the pulse sequence from the proton to the directly bound nitrogen using the scalar coupling interaction between these two spins. So for each proton frequency, we can see the nitrogen frequency. And you can see that the spectrum is all these residues shown here, which are the peaks are stemming from one residue, which contains then the proton and the amide nitrogen. So we can see that the dispersion of this spectrum is quite nice. We can see the individual amino acid residues in their own frequencies. And the same holds true also for the carbon, like the alpha carbon region here. So we can use the carbon and nitrogen frequency axis to make spectra more dispersed or the better resolution. Then if we have the labeled sample, we can do the three-dimensional heteronuclear NMR. That we first collect the first indirectly detected dimension, like in the two-dimensional experiment. And then we start collecting the second indirectly detected dimension. We can make the Fourier transfer along these three axes, and we will see that there is a proton frequency correlated to nitrogen, an alpha carbon frequency, and actually we will see that there are correlation from proton nitrogen to both intra-residual and the sequential alpha carbons. So then in this way we can build this sort of a three-dimensional correlation or four-dimensional correlation maps that we then use for the assignment of this, all these protons and nitrogens and carbon in our protein. So then finally for the remaining time, I'm giving you a glimpse of how you will start the protein in the Mars studies, even if you don't have a way that you can produce your or express and purify your protein. Can you do anything without labeling and so on? So this is like a workflow for the protein structure determination by NMR. It contains the cloning and expression purification of your protein, and then you can do protein NMR screening without any kind of labeling. But then, of course, you can do, if it looks good, you can do the isotope labeling, and that gives you a much better possibility to structure determination, study dynamics and interaction to the biological things that you want to study. Then you can do the resonance assignment, either using the homonuclear experiments. They are not suitable, maybe anything else than just very small proteins and the peptides. I'm not going into details about it. But then we will tomorrow talk about the resonance assignments, the identification of these peaks using these triple resonance experiments. Then you will get the secondary structure. You can already start doing the biology. You can titrate in your ligand, and you know at the residue level where the binding takes place and so on. If you want to go beyond that, you can collect these distance restraints and do the structure calculation and get your protein structure if it's not available. So next we will talk about a little bit of this NMR screening condition. So what you need for the sample is maybe, let's say, if you have the cryoprobe like we have, then 50 micromolar of protein is sufficient if it's not very large, so to say. But basically there's no upper limit for any Mars studies. The more the sample you have, the concentration, the better. The volume can be, for, let's say, from 250 microliters to 250 microliters or even 400 microliters, depending on what you are wanting to do and what kind of tubes you have available. pH could be anything, basically, but typically you want to stay close to your physiological pH, like a, let's say 6.5 is excellent for the NMR and most of the proteins as well. Salt concentration low enough, not certainly not going beyond 100 millimolar. It's not extremely or really necessary. Temperature could be anything. Typically, we are doing it 20 to 30 degrees, but we can tolerate between, let's say, 5 and 80 degrees. A little bit D2O for the deuterium log signal. Innovation in a way, but so that is always needed, but it's not a big issue as such. Then you want to give your full sequence of your construct for yourself or your collaborator who is doing the studies, because all these things will be visible in the NMR spectrum. So it's not only like a native sequence, but the sequence of the construct, what's really in the NMR tube. Yes. So, and as I mentioned, you can use different kind of tubes, 3 millimeter tubes if you have a huge amount of sample for the initial testing, or you can use the Shikemi tubes, which has this volume of 250 microliters. So it saves quite a bit of protein compared to this 400 microliters with the normal NMR tube. So if you don't have the labeled sample, can you do anything? Sure thing. I mean, you can see whether your protein is folded, whether it's stable, is it aggregating? You can see if you change the pH, you change the buffer, you change the temperature, you put in the ligand or substrate, what happens. You can check the structural integrity of the protein mutants. But you cannot really determine the structure on one dimensional anymore. So typically when people are, as I mentioned in this IDP part of my previous lecture, that they are studying that whether the protein is folded or not. So this is the spectrum of unfolded protein. Well, this doesn't necessarily at this point tell you very much. It looks like just the proton spectrum. But if we look at in detail, we can see that there is hardly any signals here around the 0 ppm, and there is not really signals here in the between the, let's say, beyond the 8.5 ppm here either. So if we compare this to folded protein, we can see that there are signals, the proton signals in the 0 ppm, the dispersion is much larger than for the unfolded protein. And this stems from the fact that actually in the folded protein, we have the protons in different chemical environment, like in this quark, the 140 residues. So they give you the spectrum in from different chemical environments. But in case of unfolded protein, there's only a narrow range of chemical shift because the protons are more or less in the similar chemical environment, exposed to solvent, not hydrogen bonded and so on. Not in the hydrophobic core or close to aromatic rings or so. So then you can also study whether your protein is binding ligands, like shown here for this 56 kilodalton avidine tetrameric proton which binds biotin. So if we measure the APO form, there's an expansion of the methyl region of the APO form of avidine. And when we add the small molecule biotin, there we can see that there's a, some of the methyl signals are shifting because of the pinene. Most of them stay intact, but some of the peaks are clearly shifting because the, of the biotin bond, binding. So you can check also whether your protein is really binding the ligand. One important domain of studies is the structural integrity of mutants. So you can make a mutant and see that whether it's like a in some binding assay that whether like here for the sand domain, which is a DNA binding domain, you can see that, well, it's binding to DNA, the wild type in a way, and the mutants. But then if there is no binding, you are wondering that, what is the reason? Is the protein, is this mutation functionally really good, or is this disrupting my structure in the protein? So you can nicely study this with the protein NMR. You can compare to wild type, you can make a mutation. This mutation lies in the alanine, is fine. This as well. But then these, especially this tryptophan, the glutamine mutation, is clearly making the lines broad and protein starts to aggregate. Doesn't have this nice resolution in the spectrum. It tells that the structure is disrupted. I mean, the structure is not good anymore. You can also look at that you have a tiny amount of let's say, the enzyme, and you want to see that whether your enzyme is really working towards your substrate. You can see that where your enzyme is cutting the substrate, like shown here for one enzyme that is binding and cutting the peptide bond between the pentaglycine. So we have here in the black, we can see that there are the pentaglycine alpha protein signals. But when the enzyme is put in, we can see that when the time passes by, the substrate signals start to D minus, and then the product signal starts to emerge, and you can see then that the enzyme is working, and you can even determine the kinetics of this, determine the Km and Vmax value. Finally, I want to mention the determine the hydrodynamic radius of proteins on the, let's say, on a macroscopic level, that you can make a complex, or you can compare the mutants and the wild type, and you can see that the hydrodynamic radius of the complex is changing upon the ligand binding, for instance. You can relate this hydrodynamic radius through the dioxin, for instance, which is known to be 2.12 angstroms, and then you can determine by through this relation quite easily that what is the hydrodynamic ratio of or the hydrodynamic radius of your protein or the molecule in general, just based on the proton spectrum. Okay, so that was more or less what I wanted to say.